All right, Stefan Molyneux from freedomain.com. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I'd really, really appreciate your very kind support. Now, I want to talk about the kind of subtle depopulation thing that is going on in the world. And it is a kind of modern story of hypergamy grandeur that is a subtle way of programming women to not have children, to not be satisfied. Maybe you're just like my mama, she's never satisfied. I wasn't lying, almost struck me. So, what am I talking about? Well, in the past, the stories generally were a man and a woman don't get together because both of them are flawed. Right, you can think sort of Pride and Prejudice, you can think of Emma, you can think of Taming of the Shrew, and so on. So men and women are flawed, and it is their flaws which keep them from falling in love and pair bonding and getting together. And then, when they overcome those flaws, they can fall in love and get married and move on, right? It's the classic, you know, guy chases girl. Guy gets girl, guy loses girl, and then a certain bit of knowledge or self-knowledge or something is resolved. I mean, one of the examples of this from the male side is something like Good Will Hunting, where a Will has a problem with lying and violence and so on, and he overcomes his childhood trauma and then goes and gets the girl. Now, this idea that love doesn't come to either party if either party has particular flaws, and the flaws tend to be kind of moral flaws. They tend to be things like vanity, greed, licentiousness, lust, and so on. I'm too good for him, Pride and Prejudice, with the lead male hates his attraction to the young woman and has too much pride and so on, to be honest. Or it could be cowardice that the man doesn't have the courage to ask the girl out or something like that. For the woman, it could be she has bad friends who keep her from love because of their own pathologies, which is not uncommon, right? You get a coterie of single people of both sexes, and next thing you know, they're working hard to keep each other single because it's kind of painful. If you are single and a bunch of friends of yours are single, and then one by one they start getting married off, I mean, you do begin to panic. You do begin to feel kind of bad after a while, and it's tough. So the idea that Adam and Eve, to use a sort of alpha of humanity nomenclature, the idea that Adam and Eve both have problems, and here I'm just referring to males and females, not original Adam and Eve. They both have problems, and once they work on those problems or suffer enough from those problems, then the path forward for them to fall in love is opened up, and all of these wonderful things happen. Now, of course, in Good Will Hunting, the Minnie Driver character has no flaws. She's perfect and wonderful and deep-throated and has that guttural, throaty laugh that Minnie Driver has perfected, and so on. So she's perfect, but of course, Will has to fix himself because he's male, and that's kind of the thing. Now, one of the things that happens when you place people in a victim mindset, which feminism does, right, that women are victimized and exploited and so on throughout history, one of the things that happens when you put people in a victim mindset, and this is one of the foundational reasons why they're put into a victim mindset, is you make them extremely angry towards criticism. If someone is a slave, then criticizing them for something wrong with their personality or something wrong with their work ethic or something wrong with their morals and so on, well, they're a slave. So once you put someone in the mindset of being a victim, then you can't criticize that person because they are victims, and therefore the only criticism that exists would have to be reserved for The exploiter. The man, the patriarchy, the men who dominate and control and bully and so on, right? And this is sort of encapsulated in the classic rhetoric of don't blame the victim, right? So some woman is out in a skimpy outfit and she's drunk and she's kind of bumping and grinding on guys at a club. And then something bad happens. And of course, the person who does the bad thing should go to jail and all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, we would say that prevention is the better part of cure, and life is not safe, and people are often not safe, particularly people who are out at clubs around closing time and so on. They're a little bit higher in the predator to normie ratio. But of course, if a woman is attacked in this kind of way, I mean, she's obviously a victim, and it was evil what was done to her. And the idea of criticizing her because she is a victim, you can't criticize victims. And so because women have now been portrayed as eternal and perpetual victims, they can't be criticized. Because if a woman is criticized in general, her mind immediately shifts to, but I'm a victim, men are infinitely worse, the patriarchy is infinitely worse, and therefore you can't criticize me. It's cowardly to criticize me. If a slave is being beaten by his master, then to criticize the slave is cowardly, because what you really should be doing is criticizing the master and slavery and the beating and so on, right? If a slave is beaten because the soup he serves is not warm enough, then criticizing the slave for not having the soup at the right temperature is wrong and bad, and like that would be a terrible thing to do. You would criticize the beating, the master, slavery as a whole, the institution, the laws, all of that sort of stuff, right? So once you convince people that they're victims, then they become immune to criticism. And of course, you see this all the time on social media, and it's something that I've pointed out constantly over my uppy-downy rollercoaster career in social media, which is if I criticize something about women, the pivot to male is always the case, right? And the pivot to male is because when you make someone a victim, you strip that person of moral agency, which is perfectly valid in some situations in life, of course. A 4-year-old child who is beaten by a grandfather or something, clearly, at least from the peaceful parenting standpoint, clearly the child is not a full moral agent and is a victim of circumstances, did not choose the family, did not choose the grandfather, did not choose the beating. And if you, for some reason, like let's say that you say, ah, yes, but it is valid to beat a 4-year-old child, okay, make it a 1-year-old child. A 6-month-old baby. Like, well, at some point, you have to say there's no moral agency and the child is purely a victim. So if the child pees on the caregiver and the caregiver beats the child and it's a baby or whatever, right? Then clearly the baby is not in control of the bladder and all that kind of stuff, right? So somebody who is genuinely a victim has no moral agency. Now, if you have no moral agency, you cannot be criticized. I mean, a man does not have moral agency over his eye color, his height, whether he goes bald. I mean, you can obviously wear lifts, you can wear eye contacts, and you can get gross hair transplants and things like that. Sorry, Elon, but it's true. But we would not morally blame a man for being short, for, say, having brown eyes, rather than the electric blue-green or whatever's considered icy Nordic model staring, or for being short. We would not blame, because the height, hair color, oh, sorry, hair, well, hair color too, right? We wouldn't blame somebody for being black or brown or blonde. Or, so height, a hair color, and the presence or absence of hair, male pattern baldness, and so on. These are things that people are not responsible for. Again, that's things that you can do to change it, right? You can dye your hair and so on, right? But If somebody has grey hair and decides to dye it, we don't blame them morally for having grey hair, because it's not a moral choice. It is a matter of genetics and aging and so on. If somebody... Well, it's interesting, yeah. The glasses thing, I don't know. Is it bad to read a lot of social media or read a lot of books? Is that bad for your eyes? But anyway, so... But just height, of course. No man is or woman is morally responsible for his or her height. And so where there is no moral agency, there can be no valid criticism. And so if women, for instance, and this is one of the aspects of feminism that is very strong, women are told that throughout evolution, throughout human history and way up until the present, that they are inert, passive victims that the evil patriarchy acts upon and controls and punishes and attacks and exploits and so on, right? And that they have no agency, no choice in the matter. This is the root of the complaint that I heard when I was a kid. Men are all the same. Well, that's because 80% of women are trying to have sex with the top 20% of guys, and therefore, of course, they seem to be kind of the same because they're all kind of going for the same. It's like only dating like models and saying, you know, they're kind of skinny and shallow, blah, 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 right? Hedy Lamarr accepted. So if you can convince women that they are passive, victim-only, without agency, clumps of cells, then you cannot criticize them. If somebody were to say to you, yes, there's a video of my grandfather beating me when I was 6 years old because I lost control of my bladder, if somebody were to say, well, you shouldn't have lost control of your bladder, you brought it on yourself, we would view that person as a monster. I mean, that's a horrible thing to say, and it would indicate some severe sociopathy, at least I would assume. So if you make women passive lumps of clay that are pushed around by men, men have agency, women are pure victims, then women cannot take criticism. And it is kind of a modern thing that women cannot take criticism. And if you are with someone who cannot take criticism, and they are an adult human being with moral agency and intelligence and perception and free will and so on, if that person cannot take criticism, then in a sense they are claiming the moral status of infancy, which is that you are passive and acted upon, right? You wouldn't say about a baby, let's say the parents move from Nashville to New York, right? You wouldn't say to that person when they grew older, like, why did you choose to move to New York from Nashville? I mean, those winters, Nashville's nice, country music. They would say, look, I was 6 months old. I didn't have any choice in the matter, I didn't even have any words yet, right? Now, that's somebody who's passive and acted upon by the parents. So you wouldn't criticize someone for what was inflicted upon them or positive things, right? When they were a baby, because they don't have any choice, any moral agency. So criticizing an infant makes no sense and is actually kind of corrupt. And if, you know, through feminism, women believe that they were only acted upon and that they had no choices and no preferences and so on, then, they can't be criticized. And you can see how romance stories have changed over time to accommodate the concept that women have no agency, that they're merely acted upon, that they're always victims, and therefore they cannot be criticized. And so it's very rare that in modern stories, a woman is at fault, the man is good, the woman is at fault, and the woman needs to learn how to be a better person in order to fall in love, right? In order to fall in love. So how does this translate? So you know sort of the modern standard of romance. And the modern standard of romance is a fairly ordinary woman catches the eye of a world alpha. Now, a world alpha isn't just like the coolest guy in the neighborhood or the quarterback in a small town. Like, he is a world alpha, right? Because there's no top to hypergamy. The hypergamy has no ceiling. And so you get immortal vampires, you get Christian Grey, all these kinds of guys, and they are world alphas. They're not just 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000. They are 1 in 100 million or 1 in 10 million. And they are powerful and gorgeous and tall and handsome and have great bodies and are emotionally mysterious. And a thoroughly average woman catches the man's eye, the man god. This is really a love the gods scenario in these sort of modern romance stories. Even in a story like The Housemaid, I think it is The Housemaid, you think that there's, I'm not going to spoil it much, but you think there's a woman who's at fault, but it turns out, no, the woman isn't at fault, only the man is at fault, as it turns out. Or, Goodbye Earl. Do you remember that song by the Dixie Chicks? It's really old now, decades old now, but it's about a woman who loves a guy and he's violent, right? He walks right through the restraining order and puts her in intensive care, and then they kill him, and then they sell Tennessee ham and strawberry jam out on the highway, and they live happily ever after because Earl had to die, right? So there's nothing wrong with her. The only thing that's wrong is Earl. Earl is wrong. Earl is bad. And Earl has to die. And then these women who get rid of these guys have wonderful lives afterwards. And of course, if you know anything about people, relationships, and humanity, and so on, you know that most times that a woman gets out of an abusive relationship, what does she do? Well, most often, and this is true for men as well, but we're talking about women here for the moment. So when women get out of an abusive relationship, the most common thing they do is what? Well, they get into another abusive relationship. It's as common as the wind moving and the sun rising. That's what's going to happen. So usually, and again, I've done thousands of these convos, so I think I know what I'm talking about, but usually people are stuck in these bad relationships until such time as they figure out what went wrong in their lives, in their childhoods, what bad imprinting they had, what mistreatment they had, what Stockholm syndrome bonding with dysfunctional parents or other authority figures they had that has them repeat this terrible stuff. So the women are victims. The women cannot be criticized. And what that means is that the barrier to the man and the woman getting together is always the flaw in the man. And Christian Grey, it's his prior abuse and his S&M tendencies and so on, and it could be the man's family and his cowardice before them. Mama poses, and he has to overcome that. Or I guess with is it Edward in Twilight, that he's an immortal vampire, which is a little bit on the PDF side. But he has to overcome his fear and hesitation. And you either get the skinny guy with the chiseled jaw and the great hair, or the buff semi-Hispanic werewolf, both of which are, you know, really top-tier men in terms of looks, muscularity, and strength and charisma and so on. So because women are victims, and therefore women cannot be criticized, and women are passive agents that are acted upon, the only barrier to the man and woman getting together has to be a fatal flaw on the part of the man. And you can't have Lady Macbeth, right, who encourages her husband and goads and taunts her husband, Macbeth, into killing the King Duncan. You can't have that. Because, again, women are acted upon. Women are passive agents. And so the world alpha, right, again, not just the alpha in the environment, but the alpha in the world, right? if you, again, to take Christian Grey. I mean, I go back to Christian Grey because it's the most popular work of fiction in all of human history outside of documents that claim to restrain the government. But he is, what, 27, physically gorgeous, a billionaire. He flies helicopters. He plays piano. He, you know, has impeccable taste. He, you know, you name it, right? And, you know, all he is excessively dominant, which, of course, is kind of catnip to a lot of women. So he's like a world alpha. Like, there's nobody like him in the world. He is the number one male in the world. And what is it that makes her so alluring? Because Christian Grey also chews through a bunch of other women on his way to Anastasia Steele. Oh, sorry, it kind of cringe. But what's so great about her? Well, you know, is that Dakota Johnson? She's, you know, cute and skinny, but not a goddess and not super gorgeous and not, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis in her prime in terms of the body or anything like that. But she is attractive and not particularly brilliant, not particularly confident. You know, she's very clumsy. It's all fantasy wish fulfillment. So she goes from so clumsy, which is kind of constantly signaled that, you know, she trips and is awkward and shy when she first interviews Christian Grey. And then later she tears up a real estate agent for flirting with her husband, because women have these sort of fantasies that they'll just win against predatory women. But Christian Grey is sort of the archetype of this kind of, not the first, obviously, but kind of like an archetype of this stuff. So an average woman attracts the interests of a world alpha, a man with powers that seem magical. I mean, excessive wealth and excessive physical muscularity and, you know, again, does all of the things, and speaks every language, and right, does great math and plays piano and flies helicopters and so on. And the magic of wealth and talent and looks compared to the talent of being able to run through trees and be immortal and so on with Twilight, it's magic. So Kristen Stewart, that's a good actress, but I mean, not a model, and so no great shakes with regards to her body and so on. Again, you know, fine, whatever, right? But not not generally model material. So the average woman attracts the world alpha, and she doesn't need to fix anything about herself. She has no flaws. Even the world alpha has to fix himself to be with her. That's sort of the end of the first book or movie of Fifty Shades of Grey, is after he hits her hard as a result of his sadism in the red room. It's not even the bedroom, it's the red room. She leaves and she's like, no, don't touch me. How dare you? How dare you hit me when I asked you to hit me? I mean, it's wild. Anyway, because she says, you know, do it to me. Like, do what you really want to me and really hit me. And then he really hits her. And then she's like, no. So he, as the world alpha, needs to be fixed, needs to confront his own demons, needs to change, needs to be a better person, needs to improve to be with a woman with no particular wit, talent, intelligence, or abilities who works in a hardware store and lives with a roommate. Now, I mean, these kinds of things can happen. I don't know. See, I don't know. Matt Damon married a single mom he met in a bar, and Joe Rogan married a single mom, some cocktail waitress or whatever. So, I mean, it definitely can happen, but it tends to happen before the men are world alphas. I mean, is it possible that a jacked up Jeff Bezos is going to rapidly pursue and be willing to overturn his entire personality to get a hold of a woman of no particular distinction and no great looks who works in a hardware store? Right? It's madness. Madness to even consider something like that. So nothing that gets promoted in the West is good for the West. It's a foundational fact and reality. You know, I couldn't really understand why I got such great praise for my books but could never get a publishing contract. Now, of course, this I understand it now in hindsight that white males were being rapidly excluded from publishing and so on, unless they publish something or provide stories that are really bad for the West. So everything that is promoted is bad for the West. Everything that is good for the West is attacked and ostracized and excluded and so on. Everything that is promoted is bad for the West because there's a war, right? And if France is at war with Germany, then everything that France promotes in Germany is going to be bad for Germany. And everything that Germany promotes in France is going to be bad for France. That's, you know, because you're at war. So everything that is allowed and promoted is bad for the West, which begs the question, what are these werewolf, vampire, billionaire stories? How are they bad for the West? Well, I mean, the answer, of course, is that it hyperstimulates average women to the point where average men seem repulsive to them. Let me say this again. It hyperstimulates average women to the point where average men seem repulsive to them. And we can sort of go through the etiology of this as a whole. You know, for evidence, you can look at things like the Whatever podcast, or you can look at Kevin Samuels and some of the Fresh and Fit stuff and so on, where women, we'll sit across from Brian in the Whatever podcast, and he says, like, what is the minimum yearly income for a man to be your husband? And women will say $500,000 or $1 million or things like that, right? Or women want a guy who's 6 foot tall, making six figures, he's single and not overweight. And of the, you know, what is it, 140 million men in America, they're talking about 49,000 men. Was it 0.03% or something like that of the population? And if you want to be one of the 1 in 10,000, if you want one of the 1 in 10,000 men, don't you have to be a 1 in 10,000 woman? So, also love the woman in 50 Shades of Grey, the girl who's come out of the hardware store and stumbles and bumbles her way into a business office and has no experience in business or negotiation, suddenly becomes an expert negotiator when it comes to how much of the beat me, eat me, licorice whip is going to need to be consumed in the average Red Room play session. Just hilarious. I mean, negotiation is a skill. You have to learn it. And she didn't learn it at home, and she didn't learn it in the hardware store. But now she speaks. It's like, you know, just sits down. She speaks Japanese. Just speaks Japanese, like the way she can negotiate. With the most, one of the most successful businessmen on the planet, she can just out-negotiate him. It's amazing. Anyway, so the point is to super-stimulate a woman's hypergamy by having a world alpha be obsessed with her and be able to have her quit her job and be able to have her fly around in a helicopter and be able to have her move into his gorgeous penthouse suite and admire his abs and like all of this sort of stuff, right? That she doesn't have to worry about a thing. She doesn't have to think about a thing. She just gets swept up into his world and everything becomes easy. And even though he's a world alpha and she's an average woman, he still needs to fix himself in order to keep her. He still needs to rise somehow to her level. It's wild. It's wild. So it's a super stimulus. You know, there are some birds that just, like, they'll just sit on the largest eggs. And if you give them an ostrich egg, they'll sit on that. They don't have an upper limit to the eggs that they'll sit on. Super stimulus, like this happens with junk food, right? Super salty, super sweet. You know, I have a bit of a weakness for salted caramel ice cream, which I'll have once in a while. But I mean, you wouldn't want to go straight from salted caramel ice cream to raw carrots, right? So I had a whole bunch of raw carrots today, and you know, they're not as good as salted caramel ice cream. And this is one of the reasons why I don't really eat dessert, because if I super stimulate my palate, then ordinary food tastes bland or becomes sort of cardboardy and tasteless, right? So, when you super stimulate women's expectations, ordinary guys feel repulsive to them. I mean, if you're Steve Tyler in his prime, you know, with the groupies and all of that, and there's some, I mean, you expect the top of the top, right? Like the, I always remember this, this bathroom's bigger than our whole apartment. There's this woman in the Pink Floyd movie, The Wall. And she is a very physically attractive groupie. Now, can you imagine, I don't know if Roger Waters did groupies or not, who knows, right? But can you imagine some rock star when choosing between some Pamela Anderson basketball cannons in her prime woman and then Trigglypuff, some chunky woman with looks like a second ass hanging over her elbows. He's going to be like, ooh, like I'm used to this parade of hotties. And I'm like, then an average woman or an overweight woman or whatever becomes repulsive. And I think the Chinese government has banned some of these short videos that are junk food for the female brain. It's junk food for the female brain. Because it gives women the idea that super handsome, super slender billionaires are falling out of the trees, landing at their feet, and springing to their knees with engagement rings. And what that does, of course, is it makes the ordinary man, who's perfectly suitable for the ordinary woman, it makes the ordinary man seem repulsive to these women. And so what do? Well, the women try to get the more attractive men, and they throw themselves at the more attractive men. And how do they throw themselves at the more attractive men? Well, of course, we know they offer sex. They offer sex. And so they offer sex to these men, the top 20%, top 10% or whatever. The women will offer sex, and lots of other women are offering sex, because the women do not have a realistic view of their own degree of sexual attractiveness. I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with people about this. I mean, it's kind of rough, but it's really quite important. And the conversation that you have is something like, I mean, many years ago, I talked to a guy who was, you know, I mean, a 6 or a 7. He had some money. He had some professional success, but not a lot of dating experience and so on. And he's like, well, he was like, well, a woman doesn't have to be a 10. And I'm like, well, you're not getting a 10. You're not getting a 9. You're not getting an 8. You're going to get someone on your level. And in general, if you look at most couples, again, there could be some differences in terms of the man super wealthy or whatever it is, but if you look at most couples, they're looks matched. I'm looks matched with my wife. If I want to know how attractive I am, I just look at my wife. We're looks matched. It generally is the case that people end up with other people who are similar to them in terms of looks, right? And that's natural. That's natural. People often have friends who are similar to them in terms of income and career success. And usually people play sports with other people who are at similar levels of ability, right? So you don't often see people who are really good at tennis playing people who are really bad at tennis, because it tends to be frustrating for both people, for both parties. So people end up shaking out in similar levels of competence, similar, like people who have a lot of self-knowledge and humility and wisdom don't tend to end up hanging around with a lot of people who are impulsive and don't have self-knowledge and don't follow any particular virtues or values in any consistent kind of way. And, you know, people who spend a lot of money and are continually broke, well, they don't tend to end up hanging out with people who've got a good deal of money and who aren't spendthrifts, right? Because the people who have a lot of money and who aren't spendthrifts are generally doing things that are kind of expensive. Like, hey, we're going to Jamaica next week, and, you know, do you guys want to come along? And the people who are broke can't really, or don't really do that, right? They can't. So, in general, in the long run, people shake out at their own similar levels. And again, there can be exceptions and so on, but that generally tends to be the case over the long run. Because if people are at very different levels in life, you just have less and less in common over time. And certainly this was the case when I was younger, when I was really pushing to excel and exceed and improve myself and add more value to the world and do all kinds of cool, interesting, risky, exciting things, than the people who were just kind of, you know, plodding along and not really doing much of anything professionally or anything like that. Those people and I had less and less in common over time. The same thing happens when you get married and have kids, that the people who don't get married and don't have kids, you just have less and less in common over time. And once you found someone that you really love and you want to spend the rest of your life with, I mean, you have a certain amount of patience for other people's tales of dating woes, but it does become a little tiresome or tiring after a while. So if you've ever had the conversation, you know, there's Dakota Johnson, I think, is in a scene that you'll occasionally see on social media where a woman in her mid-30s is, you know, she's like trying to settle. You know, like, is he really 5'8" or is he actually 5'6" or 5'7"? Hey, what's a couple of inches, right? Yeah. I got this guy. He's 47. 47. Yeah, but he looks great for his age. He looks like he's 40. It's like, oh my God. Right. So this woman is trying to compromise and it's really tough. I have more sympathy than sometimes people think. And that probably is my fault. Let me take sort of ownership for that myself. But I have a lot more sympathy for women than most people realize, because women are born with this golden treasure of youth and sexuality and beauty and so on. And then it, you know, sort of drains away, right? Women get a little bit less valuable as they age. Men generally get more valuable because in the exchange of excess fertility for excess resources, women's fertility declines, men's resources increase. And so I would rather be born poor and become rich than be born rich and become poor. Obviously it's tougher at the beginning, but it's better as you go forward. So I do have a lot of sympathy. It's very tough for women who have the sort of natural hubris and arrogance of everybody wants me, all the guys are pursuing me, I get, you know, 50 matches a day on Hinge or Tinder or Bumble or whatever. And, you know, guys want to take me out and they want to fly me out sometimes, you know, if you're an attractive woman and so on. And so it's tough. You know, it's tough then when you feel it kind of slipping away. And then you're like, oh, I got to lock down a guy in my 30s. Oh, I got to lock down a guy. And it's tough. It's tough because, you know, the high quality guys are in very short supply in your 30s. And the high quality guys, in general, if they're financially successful, they want to have kids. And if you're, you know, 33, 34, 35, it gets kind of dicey. It gets kind of dicey. So the men are looking for, and they're kind of red-pilled men, so, you know, they recognize the baggage that comes from a woman in her 20s. And particularly, of course, if the woman has pursued, as a lot of women do, they think that what they would find attractive in a man is what a man would find attractive in them. So, you know, they swear, they're kind of aggressive and punchy and, you know, they think that men don't take feedback. And so because men don't take feedback, they think that not taking feedback is sort of masculine. But men do take feedback, and men, in order to improve in sports and business and so on, they definitely need to take feedback. But women think that men don't take feedback because patriarchy makes them all dominant, and therefore the women don't take any feedback. So, of course, with this super stimulus or super stimuli, women end up having to subsidize sex to get anywhere close to the alphas in their environment. And of course, what this does is it makes ordinary men unappealing. There's a video of a woman who went to South Korea because she liked boy bands or something like that. And then she has these images of the average, you know, shaped like a dumpling, smoking and balding, slightly chubby Korean man, and she can't reconcile the perfection in her mind with the reality of people in the world. And so what happens is, of course, by getting women addicted to this, I shouldn't say getting, women choosing to some degree to become addicted to the super stimuli, it means that They can't pair bond. They're arrogant. They can't be corrected. They're vain. They won't submit in anything because submission is surrender to the patriarchy and the evil exploitation. They don't have moral agency, and they end up, of course, having to subsidize going up 2 to 3 points on the attractiveness scale with sexual access, which screws up their pair bonding, makes them even more bitter, and has them view men more negatively, and this kills the birth rate. So, I mean, this stuff's not accidental. It gets pushed for a very sort of specific reason, and everything that is promoted in the West is against the West. Everything that is not attacked is toxic. So I just sort of point that out, that this is a really very real phenomenon. I have found when I was younger, trying to correct women, and listen, I was open to being corrected. I'm generally open to being corrected. Certainly not perfect, but I try my best. But as a whole, trying to correct women was like trying to disarm a bomb because, again, they're just victims, and how dare you insult women. Women are perfect. Women are wonderful. So this is the vanity aspect. If you inflate women's vanity, they become uncoachable, and they then believe that they are deserving of a world alpha through no particular effort of their own. And this means that a man who is on their level is repulsive to them, in the same way that if you just eat a whole bunch of junk food, normal tasting food tastes really bad. But it's even worse than that as a whole, because you don't normally become repulsed by normal food. It is more along the lines, not of food, just to shape the analogy a little bit, but it's more along the lines of heroin. Right, heroin, famously 1,000 times better than your best orgasm. And so after that, ordinary life is gross. It's painful. It's empty. It's and so on, right? Or, you know, how would you feel if you lived for many years in expectation of a giant inheritance, like, you know, $50 million or something like some giant inheritance. And then it turns out you weren't getting it. I mean, and then you just had to go and get a job. And you hadn't, you know, developed any particular work skills or discipline. You just kind of went into debt and borrowed and chiseled your way through life because just waiting on this giant inheritance, you know, 10 years, 15 years, whatever. And then it turns out that this giant inheritance isn't coming your way. And you have to get a job on your level, which is probably some waitering job or, you know, something at the very low end. And you're incredibly humiliated. And, you know, all the people you bragged about getting all this money from, they come and order coffee and pie from you at the diner and you bring it to them. And it's just, it's a horrendous experience. It's a horrendous fall from grace. And it just creates a massive amount of bitterness. And so the fact that, you know, half of women under the age of 30 have no kids and half of them will never have any kids and 90% of them will regret it, comes out of this hyperstimulus. You've got to find someone on your level. And ladies, men become good because we are coachable. I mean, I became good at philosophy because I took a lot of coaching in philosophy. But because you think men are just, you know, powerful and aggressive and dominant and so on, and the men thump the table and you can't correct them and so on. Well, you can't really correct the alphas that you're trading sex for access to because they don't really care for your opinion because they're just there for sex and they're going to move on. And then you say, men don't commit. And it's like, well, the men that you chase after don't commit. Oh, men just ghost me. It's like, well, if you're shooting out of your league, then you're going to get ghosted. Like if I were to apply for a job as a partner in a law firm, I'd be ghosted, right? Because I don't have a law degree. I can't practice law. I can't do any of these things, right? If I applied for a job as the, you know, head oncology guy at some hospital, well, I'm not a doctor. I don't study oncology and I can't provide it. So I'm just going to get ghosted, right? Because I'm shooting for things that are way out of my league and I'm not qualified for. And so you have to keep adjusting your expectations until you get what you're actually worth. That's true in the marketplace. It's true in friendships, it's true in dating, love, sex, romance, and so on, that you have to keep adjusting your expectations until you get what you want. And part of a relationship, part of one of the most essential aspects of a relationship is not just having outputs, but having inputs, right? So my wife can correct me on things and she's right about a bunch of stuff. I can correct my wife from time to time and I'm right about a bunch of stuff. And, you know, together we're very strong and effective that way. But if you're brought up with women are wonderful and you deserve the ultimate world alpha, for working in a hardware store, well, you're not going to pair bond. You're going to get more and more bitter because sex does not buy you commitment, and the population collapses. freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much.